Before this episode of Stories Behind the Research begins, just a warning, this interview includes discussion of suicide, which you might find distressing. Remember, you can contact Lifeline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you or someone you know needs support. Their number is 131114. Have you ever wondered what it was like to do a higher degree research qualification, or why someone might consider doing one? In this podcast, we open up the world of doctoral research by delving into the stories behind the research, speaking to current CSU candidates as they navigate the trials and tribulations of their research journeys. Listen to the why, what, and how of these innovative researchers, as well as what spurred them on to pursue this research pathway. This is Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub and 2MCE FM.
Hi, I'm Dawn Tukenew from the Research and Development team at Charles Sturt University. He is a part-time PhD candidate in the Faculty of Business, Justice and Behavioural Sciences. Michael's research title is Lived Experience Leadership in Mental Health. Before we begin and have our conversation with Michael, let me read you his bio that he sent to me. Michael Elwin, originally from Alexandria, Egypt, residing in Perth, WA, is a devoted mental health advocate driven by profound personal experiences. At 14, Michael became the primary caregiver for his father, an Air Force general who faced immense post-war challenges and was rendered blind by a stroke. Following his father's death when Michael was 16, he became the sole caregiver for his mother, supporting her through severe mental health struggles. Tragically, after more than a decade of caregiving, she took her own life. These experiences have forged Michael's unwavering commitment to mental health advocacy. Michael holds a Bachelor of Business in Accounting, an MBA with distinction, a graduate certificate in mental health, a diploma in psychology, and 2 micro-master's degrees in business leadership and organizational psychology. Currently, he is pursuing a PhD focused on the role of lived experience in shaping mental health policy and services. Professionally, Michael has demonstrated exceptional expertise across child protection, mental health, contracts management, and strategic development. His ability to enhance service delivery models and foster inclusive practices is well regarded in the industry. Thank you, Michael, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You grew up in Egypt. That, to me, is quite fascinating. What was that like?
It's the land of mysteries. I grew up in Egypt in a city called Alexandria. It's a beautiful coastal city where you can see some parts of the Roman Empire still exist underwater. Yes, beautiful city. And then also 300 kilometers far away from where I used to live are the pyramids. And they are magnificent. Like, I remember driving, going to the pyramids. You will see the pyramids touching up the sky where you are 100 kilometers away from them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's very diverse culture there as well. You have mixed of people who used to live in Egypt at that time as well in the past. You have people who are coming from Italy, from Greece. It's a beautiful multicultural mini space.
Wow. And you write, at 14, you became the primary caregiver for your father, who had post-war challenges and was rendered blind by a stroke. That's a lot of responsibility for someone at 14.
Yeah. So my dad, he was an Air Force general. He fought a war, and he came out of this war with these psychological injuries. And then after years, he had a stroke. And at that time, my mom also had mental illness, but we were not aware of it. So I did not know about her mental illness, obviously, because of my age. When my dad had this stroke, it affected his eyesight, obviously. So I was the only one looking after both of them. It was not easy, especially in Egypt. You don't have support around you. It's really difficult. And we don't have like a big family. Our family is very quite dispersed in Egypt as well. So couldn't have anyone to assist. So yeah, it was something that you have to deal with.
Yeah. So I guess, were you still at school at that stage?
Yes, I was at school. Yep. Yeah.
Wow. And have you got siblings, Michael?
No, I, when I looked after my father, we were transitioning from where we used to live as well. So we moved into another house, and it was another story. But no, I was looking after him and my mom by the age of 16. So 2 years after looking after him from this stroke, he died. And from that time, I became the sole carer of my mom. And I wasn't aware fully about her mental health challenges. But when I became her sole carer, she started confiding in me about things that she sees, hears, and all the troubles that she goes through. And I didn't know what to do with this information. So there was no Google there at that time. There was no internet, as it was like used to. We used to deal with the modems, like it's really old way internet. Dial-ups, nothing to do. So I asked her first to go to a psychiatrist, and she refused. She said, no, I don't want to be locked up in a hospital. I told her, okay, let me go and speak to the psychiatrist. So I went and I spoke with the psychiatrist. And you can imagine, I was 16 years old, going to see a psychiatrist in his office, private office. And he listened to me, said, what's going on? I told him, this is what my mom telling me. People thinks that people are walking and following her and listening to her and all this sort of stuff. And then he looked at me, and you can see that he actually, it feels like he didn't care. He's just like, look, your mom had schizophrenia, and there is no cure for it. She has to take medications for the rest of her life, or you put her in a hospital. And at that point of time, I was shocked. I was like, what? And what can I do now? So I'm not going to put my mom in the hospital because of all the things that you hear about what happens there as well in Egypt. It's not modern at all as well there.
So back then, Michael, you say hospital, but back then you're talking like a mental health facility. So probably an asylum, really.
Correct. Yes, right. Correct. And that was maybe around 25 years ago as well. Yeah, so that's a long time ago. I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. So he said, the only option for you then is to give her daily medication every day. So I thought to myself, look, if I give my mom the medications, that's it. That's fine. That's my 16 years old mind, you know? Yeah. So I started giving her medications every day without fail, every day, every day. And obviously, you can imagine starting uni at that age and have this responsibility. And because of the stigma around mental illness, I was actually unable to have friends, to bring them to home, because you feel embarrassed. Something might happen, something might be said, and, you know, it's going to be really bad. So I obviously was, and I didn't do well at uni as well.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah, lots of pressure. And I also need to work as well to stay in the house and pay the bills. So it was a struggle. But to me, I was saying to myself always, look, it is what it is. She's your mom. You have to look after your mom. And there is no question about it. She is the priority. After 13 years or something, she ended her life.
Gosh.
And I didn't see that coming as well. That's the other thing. So I didn't see that coming. So that was a surprise for me. From that moment, even the neighbors, even the people around me, they actually withdrew. And you can see that they try to avoid you when you walk in the streets, because they knew about it, obviously. So they felt awkward. What are we going to tell him? Oh, let's turn our face the other way. Or maybe they have a guest and you can see them looking at me while I'm walking. So you can think that they are telling their guest, like, oh, okay, this is our neighbor who his mom ended her life. It was really difficult.
So how did that impact you?
Well, it was really difficult because I didn't know what to do and I didn't have any support, didn't have anyone to go to. So I decided to keep it to myself as a secret. So I did not talk about it. I did not share it with anyone. I started to form friendship and have friendships because I had more time on my hand now and less responsibilities. But I didn't share this with them. So I spent years not talking about it until I met someone. I was on a trip. I was in Vietnam and I met a German girl there and we were talking. And then she was like, there's something I want to tell you. I said, yeah. She said, my mom ended her life 2 years ago. And I said, no way. She said, yeah. I told her, me too.
Wow.
And we looked at each other. And at that moment, it was like a spark. Oh, connection. And to me, I felt like she gets me. She understands me. She shared that. I can share my story as well. And I started telling her about my experience. She started telling me about her experience. And we started seeing how we both, despite the distance between us, she's in Germany. I used to be in Egypt at the time. Totally different countries, totally different cultures, but share the same. That moment, that for me, when I reflect on it now, doing my research, like lived experience leadership, it was a form of informal peer support. She was not employed to do it, obviously, but she was a peer to me. So because she was a peer, she managed to build this connection that nobody else can do. Nobody else can relate. So it was so powerful.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
Was that the first time she'd ever been able to talk about it as well, Michael?
No, she talked about it with people before, but it was the first time for me to talk about it. It
Yes.
was the first time for me to start saying, well, I'm not alone in this, because you feel like you are alone. You feel like you are the only person who went through this. But in reality, no.
So that must have been a huge weight off your shoulders.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I felt relieved. I felt understood. I felt that there is nothing wrong with me. I felt like, there are other people there who can get me.
Yes. Sadly, I lost my father to suicide as well, and I'm hearing and feeling your
Sorry
story.
to hear
It's
that.
very close to my heart as
Yeah.
well. So just changing tact a little bit, you also wrote that you have a Bachelor of Business in Accounting. So to me, mental health services are like at the furthest end of the spectrum from accounting. Like, how did that journey happen?
That's part of being raised in Egypt by a military general. So my dad was always telling me, Michael, you have to be an accountant. And I said, Dad, I suck at mathematics. I hope my professors don't hear that, but I suck at mathematics and I'm not really good at it. And he's like, No. I want you to go for it. Study accounting. And then you'll be able to work in petrol firms or companies, and then you'll be able to work in banks and all that. And I was like, no. But then when he died, I thought about cherishing his memory and do what he wanted. I joined the university, and it was 4 years. It was like one of the toughest four years of my life, because studying about accounting and economics and all this stuff, it was like I found it not engaging. I found it like really static. And I did not thought about I have not I didn't have an idea that I would be at some point of time working in the field and doing my PhD in mental health. So I haven't thought about it. So my studies trajectory started by that, and then I did my MBA focusing on business side of stuff. And then after that, when I came to Australia, I did my master in social work. And this is where things started to change. I started seeing things from different perspectives. And I started loving it. It was the first time of my life to enjoy studying something. When I studied social work, it was lovely.
So, bringing us to your research, and from our conversation so far, the answer is likely obvious. But what or maybe who inspired you to pursue a higher degree by research?
So it was a mix of things. It was a mix of my personal experience myself about what happens in my life, the feeling that I want to make a change in the world. I want to change this world. I want to change this system. It is not okay. And at the same time, I worked in the field, and I still work in the field. So I worked as a support worker, and I worked in different settings, residential outreach. I worked in child protection and residential settings. And now I work as a general manager in a not-for-profit organization where I have six mental health services and people that we support every year. For me, I feel the value of lived experience is so unutilized, so unutilized. When you look at the girl that I spoke to and how powerful in 30 minutes conversation or maybe an hour, she managed to change my life. You can imagine. When actually you have someone who is doing it every day, 8 hours a day, with people every day, how powerful this would be. So for example, where I work, we have outreach, we have NDIS, and combined every year, we support 1,600 people a year.
Wow.
It's so powerful. So you're making a change in 1,600 people's lives and souls. For me, when my research about lived experience leadership for a reason, because people with lived experience bring unique perspective, bring a perspective that you cannot thought about it in uni. They bring their lived experience, their realities, their what they have been through in the system, what they have experienced, and they can talk about this with people who are going through the same thing and started providing them with hope, with ideas, with strategies. And it's this mutuality. They don't come from a position of power. They don't come from a position of, I'm the expert. I know better. You should listen to me. They come from mutuality, equality. They provide hope and support. And it's very well documented in research about the benefits of peer support. However, there are less research about the workers when they have lived experience working in senior leadership roles in mental health settings, which is the topic of my research, because I feel these people need more attention as well.
So can you explain a bit more about your research topic?
Yeah, so it's about the organizational supports and barriers from the perspective of people with lived experience in senior leadership roles within mental health settings. So you would have people working in, for example, Healing WA. We just had this year two employments for people with lived experience in strategic roles, advising. One of them is bringing the perspective of a consumer perspective, lived experience consumer. The other one is significant other. And this is only this year, 2024. Yes. So obviously the experiences of these employees, the experiences of similar employees in other organizations who are practice leads, who are managers with designated roles, where their lived experience is a prerequisite for them to get this role. This adds a different dimension. So when you have, for example, in my role, it is not a designated role.
Right.
I'm a general manager, outreach services. It is not a designated role. So I have the luxury of disclosing or not disclosing about my lived experience.
Yes.
But when I talk about the senior leaders, they are in designated roles. So their titles will contain something to the effect of lived experience something, lived experience consultant, lived experience practice lead, lived experience manager, to that effect. So the complexity or the difficulty with that is that they become, if you might say, they become very obvious in the organization that these people have lived experience. So they cannot hide it. And that adds to the complexity that, for example, they can be over-consulted because people know about them now. So they will start reaching out to them all the time, asking for questions. And you get all the other things as well. So people think that because someone has lived experience, they know everything, they should know everything, or they can represent everybody, and they can be involved in everything. And in reality, it's difficult. This is difficult. We need more roles for people with lived experience in leadership across all levels of the organizations, in all organizations.
So what I'm hearing, if people with lived experience are in leadership positions within the mental health system, they have a greater understanding of the patient's needs, the care that's required for improving outcomes, and I guess importantly, the knowledge to build frameworks concerning policies, practices, to inform a business, to inform and be of greater service, and ultimately, I guess, change and for a more compassionate and effective landscape in mental health. Does that sort of summarize it a bit?
Absolutely, Dawn. So if we are in the business of serving people with mental illnesses, then we should not only listen to what they want, but we should actually have them in leadership roles to direct the organizations, to direct the government, to direct commissioning bodies about where they want to go, what actually is required. And if you look at it from a very different, you look at food restaurant, right? any franchise or food restaurant, what they do, they actually do surveys and listen to their consumers, and they start changing the services, they're charging the products accordingly. So if food restaurants are doing it, how come we're not doing it for when we're working with people, with humans, not delivering food? We are doing way more important things. So I think that's the way to go.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
I would imagine, well, I know that if I was seeking a counsellor or a provider to support me in, say, you know, the aftermath of my father's death, if I saw someone wearing a badge that said lived experience, I would be automatically attracted to that person, because you want someone who has been on the journey before you to feel supported and to feel heard and to feel understood. I love this, Michael.
100%. 100%.
Yeah. In the system at the moment, how is lived experience? Because for me, people who have had trauma in their life and overcome it are usually attracted to working in the industry. I'm guessing they are dispersed throughout the system at the moment.
Correct. Sadly, the system have lots of stigma around people with lived experience. And it is ironic if you are working in the system to support people with lived experience, to support individuals who are experiencing such mental distress. It is really ironic that actually the same system is stigmatizing against it when you start working with that capacity. So research suggests that people with lived experience tend to either conceal their lived experience and work in non-designated roles, like myself, for example. When I started working, I worked as a support worker, I worked as a case manager, and I worked in these different settings without talking about my lived experience. I was like, no, okay, I'm not going to talk about it because I think people will start to discriminate against me. And this is sadly the reality in the system, that despite having lived experience, the emphasis is on academic qualifications.
Yes.
And also the pay is not as good. And also the opportunities to progress in your career as a peer worker, almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? The reality, are you going to be peer worker and then what? Senior peer worker and then what? The other thing as well is there's the supervision. So in our industry, you need to have supervision from someone with the same level. So if you have a psychologist, they will have supervision from a fellow psychologist, for example, or a nurse, she will have, or he will have a nurse to do clinical supervision for them too. But for peer workers, the expectation or what's happening in reality that they rarely get supervision from fellow peers. So they get the expectations that, okay, like any other one, you will get the supervision from your line manager or whatever. So that's also not okay. The other thing is that the expectations from work around peers. So, for example, when we say peer workers or people with lived experience in general will be in a service, what do we mean by being included? Are we just going to hire them and then leave them, or just let them without any formal support and then you will tick the box of inclusion? Or are we going to include them and expect that they will follow the process or adhere to the system which they want to change?
Yeah.
And they become what is often referred to in literature as mini clinicians. So they become mini clinicians. Their fellows, staff workers, stop working with them, most likely don't understand the value they bring to the service. So they start giving them tasks that they don't want to do. So they say, okay, you can do this. Could you please do this? Could you please do that? So they bring different perspective, and it has to be acknowledged. That is different perspective, so powerful perspective. So in order for this to happen, organizations need to be ready to have them in. Organizations need to have proper policies, procedures, training in place, not training only for peer workers, but trainings for all staff at all levels about the value of people with lived experience. So that is where the research that I'm looking at now is, when these people are in senior roles, the expectation that they have the authority, they have the power to make such changes. Can they? The question is, can they? Or what is preventing them? Or what enables them to do that? Because if you have someone with lived experience in a senior role, you would think, okay, they have access to resources, access to budgets, access to influencing the organization's policies, procedures, even strategic directions. That's where the research that I'm looking at will be focusing on.
So how has your research progressed so far?
I'm at the very early stages. This is the second semester. And I am in the literature review phase of my research proposal. And I would like to please give a shout out to my supervisors. So I have Professor Russell Roberts, who is the principal supervisor for this research. I have Professor Linda Cash, and I have also Professor Tanya Pierce from University of New England. She actually used to supervise my capstone at the at my Master of Social Work, which was really interesting that now we are working together on a PhD. So I would like to take this opportunity to thank them very much, because I believe having a such supportive, knowledgeable, and really encouraging supervisory team makes a big difference. When I started in this journey, and since I started in this journey, the support and the time and the efforts and the energy they put into assisting me and guiding me makes a huge difference. Linda Cash comes straight to my mind when you mentioned that I will go to her straight away. I said, Linda, this is what happened. Please listen to me. Please, I would like to debrief. She's very supportive. She goes way above and beyond.
That's terrific. It's so good to hear you're so well supported. So in your literature reviews and the things and what you've done so far, is there anything that stands out or surprised or excited you?
Obviously, the first thing that stood out for me was the lack of research around people with lived experience in senior roles. The focus is mainly on peer workers, as I mentioned. And it's all about, and it's kind of sad, because it gives you the impression that even researchers think that people with lived experience cannot do anything more than peer, just for frontline support, which is, it's sad. I think we need more research about people with lived experience in senior roles. And what one of the things that also I was surprised to read was that people, when they go in senior roles, their experiences not necessarily could differ so far from peer workers. It feels like it is same, but on a different level. Obviously, this needs to be explored further and investigated and discussed. I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited. Every time I read an article, I feel excited, especially when I find something new.
Do you find that time just disappears in those moments?
Oh yes. So I tended to sit in front of my computer and start reading journal articles. And I have two kids, right? So I have three, almost four now, 4 years old boy and 1.5 year girl. And my son comes to my office and he's like, "Dad, are you reading journal articles?" Yes, I am. So he knows, because he sees me all the time getting absorbed in this, like focusing on this, and I lose track of time, which is quite enjoyable. It is really enjoyable.
You work full time as a general manager. You've got two young children and you're doing research. How are you managing all of that?
I have no idea. No. I have to say, without the support, the full support of my wife, I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't be able to do it, honestly. So a big shout out to my wife, Emma, for being so supportive, for being always encouraging me. Because, look, I work full time. It is an industry where you face lots of challenges because of the type of work that we do. So you have to be always focused. You have to be always present. And at the same time, I have two kids and my family who I need to look after. One of the things that I think as well assist me in this process is not having social life.
Mm.
So what What happens is I work and then come back home and then spend hours with my family talking about the day, etc. And then I start reading articles and then I go to sleep,
Yep.
right? But then on the weekend, spend some time with my family, go out for the kids' swimming classes or whatever, and then come back and also start working on my research Saturday and Sunday. So almost there is no social life as such, but I'm enjoying it. So I don't reg so I'm not regretting it, which is really important. Because if there is no social life and I feel like, okay, oh, this is not good, it would be dreadful. But contrary, I'm enjoying it. I don't want to change it. I'm very happy with that. I'm really having so much fun.
That is great. And they say that doing undertaking research, you learn a lot about yourself. Is it, have you learned anything about yourself already?
So what I've learned first is that I cannot multitask. So it's either I'm working, or either I'm studying, or either I am doing something with the family. I cannot do anything, like I cannot mix, which is okay. That's right. What else I've learned about myself? I've learned about myself that when I believe in something, I will not stop until it is done. As you know, the research process, especially in the early stages, you change topics, you change directions, you change this, you change that. So if you're not fully focusing or not fully determined to do that research or to do this type of research, you might lose interest.
Yes.
You might give up. But for me, I'm not. For me, whatever direction is going, I'm enjoying it.
And have you discovered like people as you've gone through this?
Oh, yes. So I discovered like people in terms of lived experience, which is really interesting. So I went, and thanks to Russell and Linda, I managed to go to the Equally Well Forum this year, and I met like-minded people, from people who have lived experience, people who are working in the field with lived experience, people who are consumers, survivors, ex-patients. It felt very, very powerful. The forum and the people around you, it felt like it's you are with your tribe. It felt like you are with your people. So we were very connected. You can feel the care, you can feel the empathy, you can feel the support from everybody around you. I've been to conferences in different industries and different contexts, and it's very competitive. People competing with each other, people were like, okay, I want to do this, I want to do that. But when you are around people with lived experience, whether they are researchers, consumers, survivors, ex-patients, service people working in this in the industry, they have different vibes. They have this care vibe, and I believe it's part of the crucibles that they experience in their lives. When you go through adversities, you start to feel that I want to treat people differently. I don't want people to see what I've seen or experience what I've experienced. And this is perhaps one way of looking at it. And it could be also an interesting thing to consider for people with lived experience who are in senior leadership roles. What are their leadership styles? Like, how is it different, the traditional leadership style? And how this might actually impact their work. So if they are coming from the perspective of mutuality and solidarity, how this will translate when they are working with people and or staff or people reporting to them, how this will actually could make a challenge between them and their managers
Yes.
when their managers expect them to perform as any other person in the industry or in the organization. I think they bring a different or a unique leadership style too, which is worth exploring.
I think so. It sounds like it would be soul based. That the power that you're talking about it and getting groups of people like that is empowering because people are lifting each other up and supporting each other rather than treading on.
Yes, exactly. That's how it felt. Exactly.
That's great, Michael. So, if any of our listeners are perhaps sitting on the fence thinking about, oh, this all this research, that sounds sort of interesting, and maybe I could do that one day, what would you say?
First advice, talk to your partner if you have one.
Oh,
Talk to your talk to your partner, make sure that they are okay with it, right? That's the first thing. Secondly, you need to find really supportive supervisors. The supervisory team makes a huge difference. So my confidence in my ability to do research was very, very minimal. And still, it's not great, obviously, because I'm still in the early stages. But the support that I'm getting from Belinda, the support that I'm getting from Russell, from Tanya, makes me feel like, okay, I can do it. I can do it. Because you're not sure. Can I do a PhD? Can I? I don't know. But when you find this supportive supervisors who believe in you, who invest time and energy to give you this directions and boost of confidence, you feel like, yeah, I got this, I can do it. So my advice is find supervisory team who believe in your research topic, because it's a big investment. It's like lots of time. So they will need to be actually enjoying it as well as you. So find a supervisory team who enjoy or are interested in your research topic. And if you can, find people who will invest in you as well, not only your research topic, because it goes hand in hand.
Powerful combination. If anyone wants to learn more about your research, what's the best way to do that? Have you got a website or a LinkedIn or anything else, Michael, that you'd like to give a shout out about?
Yes. When I'm not at my work, when I'm not working, what I do is that I go on LinkedIn and start posting stuff. I start posting stuff about lived experience. I start posting stuff about how we can change the current system. And you can find me on LinkedIn. It is Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L dot Ilwan, E-L-W-A-N, in LinkedIn. So you will find me there.
That's terrific. Well, thank you for joining us today, Michael, and to our listeners for tuning in. Congratulations on undertaking such important research. From a personal perspective and in my experience, the mental health system I have gone through didn't offer a lot of compassion or understanding or hope. And after listening to you and understanding a little more, I would suspect it was because I was dealing with people without lived experience. So I'm hopeful for your research, and my wish is that it's impactful and far-reaching and offers real and life-changing care for the people that need it most. Thank you, and thank you for sharing your personal journey and your story and your research. I wish you all the best in your progress, and you are just going to go from milestone to milestone, and I'm very excited for you, Michael.
Well, thank you very much, Dawn.
For our listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll catch you on our next episode. Until then, stay curious, keep exploring, and continue to make a difference in the world.
Thank you for tuning in to Stories Behind the Research. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. To learn more about higher degree pathways, visit research at csu.edu.au. If you have a story to share and would like to be featured on our podcast, email us at researcherdevelopment@csu.edu.au. And just a reminder, if this episode's discussion of suicide and mental health challenges has brought up anything for you, help is always available. You can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.